welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode 186 of the podcast. I'm recording this on the 12th of June in advance of it going out next week because I'm travelling a little bit, so I'm getting my ducks in a row as such. So today I am super, super, super excited, and you can tell in my voice during the interview. I actually start off quite nervous, as today my interview is with Stephen Pressfield, author of The War of Art, Turning Pro, plus screenplays including The Legend of Bag of Vance and a number of novels around the classical wars of ancient Greece and modern warfare. His latest book is The Lion's Gate, which is a hybrid history of the Six-Day War. And we start the interview by talking about that book and our mutual passion for Israel. And then I get into some deeper questions around resistance and creativity. Plus, Steve kicks my ass about self-censorship in writing, which is brilliant. It was so good to finally meet Steve in person. And this interview means a lot to me because I consider Steve to be one of my mentors, even though I've never met him. I consider my mentors to be people whose books I read. And I've been reading his blog for ages. And he's the only author I own in print, ebook, and audio version. And I reread Turning Pro, you know, pretty much every 6 months. I have it on my desk. I certainly read it over the new year. It helps me to focus, helps me to keep going, I guess. And I have a quote from The War of Art on my pinboard, which I show him in the interview and I read aloud. So you can definitely tell I'm a fangirl. You can, if you would like to see our discussion, you can watch the video on my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/thecreativepen, pen with a double N. And very brief update, I finally today typed up all the little notes on Delirium, and after such a mega rewrite, it's gone back to my editor, and brilliant edit from Jen Blood, yes that's her real name, who helped me, and she really gets my writing. And I must say that having an editor who can help with structure as well as the line edits is brilliant. And I've been through a number of editors, so it's good to finally find one who understands my need to kill people in my writing. Anyway, so on to the interview with Steve after a short word from our sponsor, Kobo Writing Life.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo. I wanted to provide a little bit of a tip. I often hear from authors who are already selling well on a particular platform, whether it's Kobo, whether it's Kindle, whether it's Nook, or whether it's Apple. Those tend to be the main places that people are selling. If you're already doing well on one platform, that's great. But consider, there are other platforms out there. And those platforms each come with their own unique sets of customers. So you may be doing well on one platform, but there's a whole world of customers out there available on the other platforms. Yes, I work for Kobo, and of course I want to have your titles in our catalog. But as an author myself, I strongly advise that authors also make their work available in all of the catalogs, because you never know when that customer who's the ideal customer, who's going to love your writing and tell all their friends and help spread word about how amazing you are as a writer, you never know what platform they're reading on. And that's why it serves you best to be available across all platforms to get the broadest reach for audience in the world. You can find more tips like this available at KoboWritingLife.com. Do come check us out. And if you're looking at making your work available globally, come to Kobo Writing Life and publish your work directly to Kobo's catalog for 190 countries. I'm Mark Lefebvre from Kobo. Now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi, Stephen, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Joanna. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to meet you in Skype after all these years.
Yes, you too. So perhaps for anyone who doesn't know you, perhaps you could give us a brief overview of your writing career, just to put this new book, The Lion's Gate, into context.
I was a screenwriter for years. And then around 1995, I think I started writing novels. And I've written a number of kind of war-themed books. Gates of Fire was about the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. And then I've done like five or six other Hellenic war stories about Alexander the Great, about Alcibiades, the Peloponnesian War. And I've written about the Brits, about you guys in World War II and the North Africa campaign. And then one day it just kind of hit me about 3 or 4 years ago. I said to myself, Steve, you've written about all these other people, but never about your own people. So why don't you? And then the Six-Day War was an important event in my life, you know, just in America. Mm. And an incredible story that I would rank with the great, you know, with Trafalgar or, you know, anything. So that was why I wanted to do this.
And then I guess for anyone who doesn't necessarily know about the Six-Day War, because I guess it was a while ago now,
right.
Could you just, you know, give us a brief sort of overview of the events that happen in the Lion's Gate?
Okay. In 1967, Egypt had a president named Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was probably the greatest and most charismatic Arab leader or leader that any Arab nation has had. And he saw himself as the epicenter of a pan-Arabic movement. He envisioned a state of single Arab state from the Atlantic all the way to Afghanistan with himself at the head. And at the time, that seemed quite believable because when he would make his speeches, they would be cheered just as much in Baghdad and Damascus as they were in Cairo. So anyway, for reasons known only to himself, he began really rattling sabers around May of 1967, moved 1,000 tanks, hundreds of men across Sinai onto to the borders of Israel. And Syria was with him, and Jordan signed a pact, King Hussein signed a pact, and it was a kind of an existential moment for Israel where one of the soldiers that I interviewed over there was telling me that the song by The Doors, The End, my phone is ringing in the background, was popular then, if you remember that, where the, I just did this. And if you remember a verse from that song,
you can answer it if you want.
It's my facts. this is the end, my friend. This is the end. And the soldier says that was what it really very much felt like. Mm-hmm. And so Israel, with their backs to the wall, launched a preemptive strike against Egypt, an airstrike. And 6 days later, the tables had completely turned. Israel had utterly trounced the Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian military forces and changed the entire balance of power in the Middle East and captured the West Bank, captured the old city of Jerusalem, captured the Sinai Desert and the Golan Heights. And all of these kind of things that you see going on now, the troubles, sprang from that particular change in the Middle East when the borders all changed.
Yeah. And it's such a dramatic story. And in the book, you've taken these interviews and turned them into something a lot more personal. Maybe you could talk a bit about your research process and what that meant to you.
Okay, that's a great question, Joanna. Now, I've always, before this, I'd always written novels, historical fiction, you know? Whereas, you know, you get to make things up. And if you have a part of the story that doesn't work, well, you just write a scene and da da da. But in this case, that absolutely couldn't work because the history was so this is what just came in, you know, some terrible, you know, advertisement.
Oh, fantastic.
Making all that noise. So I knew I'd have to, so I went over to Israel and I wound up interviewing 67 or something veterans, fighter pilots, tankers, men and women. And I had 400 hours of interviews. And I just sort of what I learned from this process as a writer is that nonfiction is fiction. in the sense that I don't mean you can make anything up, but in nonfiction, you have to go by the rules of storytelling. This was narrative nonfiction. So in other words, I put it together as an artist would put it together and, you know, moved one interview here and one interview there and cut this and cut that and to tell a whole story with recurring characters where in chapter one, you meet Cheetah Cohen. And he tells you his story about it and his brother. And then he comes back in chapter 11, comes back and is woven in throughout the story. And the same with a lot of the other characters. And a bunch of the characters know each other. So their stories kind of intersect. So I hope that explained it a little bit.
Yeah, it does. And what I think what's interesting, because you have a mixture of older and younger characters and women and men and, you know, different levels. How did you choose the people to feature specifically?
I knew I wasn't going to try to tell the whole comprehensive story of everything that happened. What I wanted to do was a little bit like Saving Private Ryan or Black Hawk Down. Just focus on three or four units and just pick a few people in those units and then follow them. And the emotional climax of the war was when the Israeli paratroopers reached the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall. So I knew I wanted to talk to those guys. I wanted to find the first guys that got to the Western Wall. So I went for after them. And then I also wanted to be with whoever the first Israelis were to get to the Suez Canal going across the Sinai Desert. So through luck and other things, I found them. And then I also wanted to find like one squadron in the Air Force that led an attack. Mm. So that was kind of it. And then serendipity came in, of course, and one person introduces you to another and so on and so forth. And I had a friend named Danny Grossman, a retired Israeli Air Force lieutenant colonel who knows everybody knows everybody in Israel. I didn't. I never do that. So he really helped me get in, made a lot of phone calls and, you know, introduced me to people. Mm-hmm. Without him, I could have never done it.
Yeah, and I think what obviously runs through the book and through much of history, I guess, is that it's sort of triumph and winning, but also great loss on both sides. So how did you get the balance right between winning the war, but equally the ongoing battle and also the loss of life?
You know, it's funny, Joanna, when I started out, of course, and before I talked to everybody, I really didn't know what the casualty situation would be. And then as it began to unfold naturally, a lot of people got killed. And the people I was speaking to, I mean, on the Israeli side and on the Egyptian side and the Jordanian too, but I was doing it entirely from the Israeli side. So the people that I talked to felt these loss of their friends very deeply, and it was very much a part of the story. And they would keep telling me, you know, like, for instance, one central character of the story is a guy named Cheetah Cohen, who was a helicopter pilot, and his younger brother, Nehemiah, was the most decorated soldier in the Israeli army. And he was killed on the first day of the war. And so when I started talking to Cheetah, that became a huge thread of the story, because one of the things, I know you know this, was when Nehemiah was killed, a decision was made not to tell Cheetah, not to tell his brother. Mm. And this was the first day of the war because they thought it would upset him. He was too valuable a person being a helicopter squadron commander. So they kept it from him all through the war. And then he found on the final day when the mood was jubilation of victory, he found out he'd lost his brother. So that was a big, big part of the story. It's kind of organically evolved.
Yeah. And also you've been blogging about this, you know, at stephenpressfield.com. And one of the things you've talked about is the concept of, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Enbrera.
Right. Very good.
Yeah.
You can feel many more times than I have.
My husband is Jewish, so I try and get a bit of Hebrew pronunciation in. But why did the Israelis have no alternative, which is what the phrase means for everyone else, and perhaps, you know, still don't necessarily have an alternative?
That's another great question. And the answer really is geography. That one of the things that really amazed me when I went over, this was the first time I'd ever been to Israel, is how small it is over there, as you well know. I remember reading it before I went there in Yael Dayan's book, Moshe Dayan's daughter. She was on the front lines in Sinai just before the war with Sharon's division, and she got a chance to go home. So she just drove home. In 2 hours, she was home. So in other words, as Israel Tal was one of the great armored division commanders, and when he was giving a speech to his troops, he said that other nations can afford to lose the first battle and still recover and win a war, but we can't because the distances are so small. If we lose the first battle and Nasser's tanks cross the border, they'll be in Tel Aviv an hour later. So that's kind of the en brera, no alternative, just built in to Israel. The waist of the nation, as you know, in the pre-67 borders is only 9 miles wide. Mm-hmm. So a fighter plane coming from Jordan could literally cross the border and leave in less than a minute. So there was no such thing as a strategy of defense and depth. It just couldn't work in such a tiny country.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I've been there 11 times now, which I said on my email to you. And I was actually there in 1990 when the Scud missiles were coming in from Iraq. And there was this real sense of how small the place is. And, you know, it's just kind of crazy. But I was going to ask you, so you went there. And I mean, I love the Western Wall is just an amazing place. And what were the places in Israel that really sort of resonated for you?
That's another great question. The Western Wall certainly is a very powerful thing, even though today it's become, as you know, this big, huge plaza and not like it was where it was a little tiny alley in 1967. But actually the countryside was where it affected me the most. I went to visit one unit of a reconnaissance company on the Golan Heights, which is volcanic. As you know, it's really wild countries like Scotland in a way. You know, you're up in the hills there and there's a lot of kind of low-lying scrub and everything. And I don't know why, but that really affected me. There are wrecks of tanks everywhere. You see trenches where hand-to-hand fighting and at the same time, it's beautiful with the spring flowers and stuff like that. And another place was Masada, where the Roman legions besieged the last Jews who had taken refuge on top of this mesa. Mm-hmm. And that was very powerful by the Dead Sea. I know you've been there. It's, you know, really desert, unbelievable desert.
Mm.
And you could, from the top of Masada, as you know, you can see the Roman siege works where they were building this ramp coming up, and how if you were trying to hold out on the top of that thing, you could just see your time running out. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, and in case people don't know, that the Jews left there, committed suicide rather than be captured, which still is reflected in the character, I think, of the, you know, today's Israelis very much. I don't think they would have given up easily if things had gone the other way during that war.
No.
That's for sure. But what did you get? I wondered whether you got to Megiddo at all, which is, you know, the biblical Armageddon.
I did, but only, you know, it's pretty nondescript place. You know, all I did was I sort of drove past it three or four times, and it's like somebody points out the window, oh, yeah, that's Armageddon. There you go. And you go, oh, really? Was your experience different, Joanna? Did you go there and really feel something?
I did go on the dig there, but I think the iconic James Michener's book, The Source, which I'm sure you've read, was based on that dig, and I just love it there because, of course, it represents why Israel has always been such a country of blood. It's because it's right in the middle of all these trade routes, and everybody wants it basically. But no, fantastic city. But anyway, back back to the book. I'm going to keep propping it up here. You've referred to The Lion's Gate as the book you've avoided writing. And of course, the resistance is one of your key concepts, and we'll come back to that. But how has resistance manifested in this book for you?
Well, that's another great question, Joanne. It's actually probably two answers. I mean, in a way, I don't think it really was resistance. We'll get back to that. We'll talk about it. But this, for me, I think it was more sort of a Jewish midlife crisis for me. You know, I'm too old for it to be midlife, but whatever it is. But I sort of felt like, because I was raised, I'm probably like your husband, right? Kind of a non-observant Jew. You know, my uncle, Charlie Moses, his company manufactured Christmas tree ornaments. And when Christmas would come around, we'd go over to his house. He'd have like inflatable Santa Clauses on the roof, and you know, it was all everything. So for me to plunge into this book, knowing I was going to be interviewing 70 people and living over there and everything, I thought, this is really going to make me confront my own feelings about being a Jew and being a secular Jew. Should I move to Israel? Should I start studying Hebrew? Is my life a fake because I've never, you know, all those kind of things. So that's kind of why I was avoiding this book kind of over years. Mm-hmm. In fact, like Gates of Fire, in my earlier book that was about the Spartans, I was made an honorary citizen of Sparta. Mm-hmm. So I remember thinking at the time, you know, why am I doing this with Greeks? You know, why shouldn't I be, you know, with my own people? You know? So that was kind of why I avoided it. But also it was the reason why I wanted to do it, because I knew it would change me, you know.
Yeah. And then before we come back to resistance, I wanted to, so a question about spirituality really is, I mean, you've gone into Judaism here, but you've talked about your classical, I guess, prayers to the muse. You used Bhagavance was based on the Bhagavad Gita. So how has spirituality played this part in your writing life, and has anything changed now?
Another great question. I mean, yeah, I'm very much a believer, and you probably are too, that there are two levels of reality as an artist. And that we're down here on the lower level, and there's a higher level, which I think of as the muse or whatever you want to call it, wherever ideas come from. And we writers, you know, we all know, and I know your audience is mostly writers, that ideas don't really come from us, do they? Mm-hmm. They come from some other place, and we know how you can get on a roll and you're just sort of automatically typing it, and you look back and you go, wow, that's really good, you know. So for me, just trying to be a professional writer and get a handle on that dynamic has made me very humble in the face of this higher dimension. I always say a prayer to the muse. I did a T.E. Lawrence's prayer from the Odyssey, his translation of the Odyssey. And you know, I'm very definitely a believer in that level of spirituality, that we are on a lower plane and there is a higher plane. And actually, this gets into resistance a little bit. In Jewish mysticism, which I didn't know about this until a couple of years ago, it's kind of the same concept that we are on the material plane, and the higher plane is called the neshama, the soul. And the neshama is trying to communicate down to us as we are trying to communicate up to it. And there's a force in Jewish mysticism called the Yetzer Hara that is there to, its purpose is to block, you know, like a force of evil to stop us. And I definitely, that's what I call resistance with a capital R. Mm. It's, you know, when writers have a hard time working, that's why. So we can talk further about that, but I'll stop for the moment.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's get a bit more into that, because, you know, is resistance basically anything that stops us from creating? It's just a big defining concept, I guess. Can you make that more specific?
Well, I always experienced this. This comes from a book of mine called The War of Art, as you know, and I talk about a force called, that I call resistance with a capital R. And like right now, as we're talking, I'm sitting, you can't see it, but here's my keyboard, you know, right here in front of me, which this is. And when I sit down in the morning, I feel like this negative force radiating off that keyboard that's like trying to keep me from doing my work. And to me, I consider it's all self-generated. I don't think it comes from out there, but it's that, you know, it's why we buy a treadmill and bring it home and then we never use it, right? Anytime we're trying to access a higher part of ourselves, I think, this shadow element enters the picture, like an equal and opposite force to the force of creation. Like another analogy I use is like if a tree, we have a tree, and that's our dream, our novel, or whatever creative thing, that tree casts a shadow. And as soon as that tree goes up, the shadow appears. And that shadow is self-sabotage, procrastination, stubbornness, arrogance, fear of failure, fear of success, all of those things that we as writers know. And so to me, a big part of being a writer is learning to deal with that. And people do, everyone finds their own way to deal with it. To me, I've said this many times, the writing is the easy part. The hard part is sitting down and actually starting to hit the keys. So I'm a big believer in professionalism and being a pro, and in the sense that a pro doesn't allow those negative things to stop her. She sits down and does her work.
No, absolutely. I have to show you something now because it's
okay.
Right by my by my desk, I have. You probably can't read it there, but it's a quote.
Oh, yeah, I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the quote from The War of Art. On the field of the self stand a knight and a dragon. You are the knight. Resistance is the dragon. The battle must be fought anew every day. And that's, I look at that every day. And it's so great to hear you talk about this because that, from what you've said, you still get that every day. You're still fighting that battle after
absolutely
so many years.
Yeah, never. I don't think it ever goes away for anybody. Actors, photographers. I mean, when I wrote The War of Art originally, I thought it's only for writers. Only writers will be interested in this. But, of course, I've gotten letters, you know, by the hundreds from people I never would have thought, you know, people who train animals, so they have resistance, you know. I think anytime we're trying to move from a lower level to a higher level, capital R resistance will kick in and try to keep us on that low level.
And so I guess one of the things you say about in turning pro, more booksy, I have it here, is the difference between an amateur and a pro is in their habits. Are habits the way to beat resistance? And what are some of the habits of a pro?
Well, first of all, Joanna, thank you for being so informed and Pressfield, Indiana here. You know, this is
a PR agent.
It's good for my ego. I think that when I was trying to learn to be a writer and was falling on my face over and over and over, the reason I decided finally was that I was an amateur and I had amateur habits and I thought like an amateur. And what sort of turned the corner for me was just a simple sort of turning a switch where I just kind of decided I'm going to turn pro. I'm going to think like a pro. And one of the things, and this is true, a lot of times I think of athletes are great models for this. One of the things about a professional athlete is they will play hurt, right? Whereas an amateur, you know, you sprain your ankle or something's wrong, you say, I won't do it today, you know? But a pro goes every day. And I think that a lot of times the model for being a pro is just what we do in our jobs, like in our day jobs. Like in our day jobs, we show up every day, whether we want to or not, right? We have to get a paycheck, right? And we stay on the job all day, every day. We don't go home. We don't just say, it's 10 o'clock. I'm tired of this. I'm going home, right? So, but yet, when we go into our works of passion, our novels or our books or whatever, we suddenly become amateurs and we think, wow, this is really hard. I'm going to, you know, go to the beach, you know, or, you know, somebody, the kids are making noise. And so we go out and play with them, you know? And we don't have that kind of hardcore professional attitude. Courage plays a lot, takes a lot of guts to do this. Patience is also very important, you know, to be patient with ourselves, allow ourselves to fall off the wagon sometimes, you know, and to taking the long view is another aspect of it. Not imagining we can write our novel in a week and a half. Right? And also, I like to think of it as a lifelong practice that it's not just one book, it's not three books. This is what we're going to do for the rest of our lives. This is what we do. This is who we are. And another aspect, I think, of a professional, and this comes from the Bhagavad Gita that you mentioned, is the Bhagavad Gita is, I'm sorry if I'm telling you and your audience things they already know, but it's a kind of a mentor-protege story, a Hindu scripture, really, where the protege is Arjuna, the great warrior, and the teacher is Krishna, who is his charioteer, in other words, God in human form. So God is teaching a mortal man. And one of the things that Krishna says is we're entitled to our labor, but not to the fruits of our labor. And what he meant by that is like we finish a book, it goes out, it's published, and then we're like glued to the reviews. You know, are we going to get any four-star reviews? Anybody going to give us money, right? And what Krishna is saying is that's not the way the world works. The satisfaction needs to come from the work itself, from doing the work itself. So good or bad, whatever the response to our work is, that doesn't matter. We can't. And Hemingway used to say this too, if you believe the critics when they tell you you're great, then you have to believe them when they tell you you stink, you know? So he said, I don't want to believe anything. So yeah. I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm blathering on.
No, it's great. And I have that quote down as one of, again, another favorite quote, because so often we write a book and everyone expects to get this instant success. And I mean, looking at, I guess The War of Art's a good example, because didn't it become a multi-million bestseller years after you actually first put it out, and you got on Oprah years later? I mean,
right. It was like 10 years, and it's not a multi-million by any means, but it took 10 years for it to finally reach a sort of a critical mass and actually have people hear of it.
Yeah, which is kind of crazy. And I know from your work, you had incredibly hard times at the beginning of your career, right? You were living in a car, I believe.
Don't all writers have hard times?
But weren't you living in your car or something at one point?
Well, I was living in a van, but I wasn't, you know, I mean, I was couch surfing, as they say, you know, I was visiting friends and that kind of stuff, you know, yeah, mooching off friends.
But I wanted to ask you there about, because the other thing in turning pro is that a pro doesn't compare themselves to other people. And I think, well, I certainly find this very difficult. And I wondered if you had any tips. How do we not wake up in the morning, hear about someone else's success and compare ourselves?
That's a tough one. You know, it's like I agree with you. I hate those stories, you know. You know, so-and-so wrote a book in 3 days and it's now at the top of that. You know, I hate those stories. But I think we just have to sort of tell myself, like, I imagine Krishna floating over the air and saying to me that it's human to be jealous or to, you know, compare yourself. But you got to get a handle on that and just stop yourself, you know. You got to be the old analogy they used to use in the ancient Greece, I'm sure in the English school system, you guys still study this, was the chariot and the charioteer, right? The horses, maybe that's our crazy jealous self, but we have to hang on to the reins and make those horses, you know, stay in their lanes and do what we want them to.
No, fair enough. And another weird thing that I ponder as a writer is the balance between ego, because we have to have enough ego to want to publish, and self-doubt, the feeling that we're completely rubbish. How do you manage that, or, you know, do you have to manage that?
Well, I think those feelings of self-doubt are resistance, capital R resistance, and I think they're just false. It's not true. And you just have to simply, for me, when those feelings arise, I just banish them. You know, I don't allow them. I say, well, that's resistance. That's, you know, one of the theories of resistance is, and I said this on the Oprah show, is that we hear these voices in our head, like self-doubt, and we think those are our thoughts, but they're not our thoughts. That's resistance. You know, it's like when you sit down and meditate and you're trying to clear your mind and all this crazy stuff goes through your mind, right? But you if you have a teacher tells you, just let the thought cross your mind and keep moving, you know? So when I have any self-doubt thoughts, I just banish them. I say, that's resistance. That's not me. And also, I think, Joanna, it's a professional attitude. A professional says, I'm not going to entertain those thoughts for a minute, because if I do, I'm going to lose. An athlete says the same thing, right? If you're on the starting line of the 100-yard dash or the 100-meter dash is in your place, and you start to think, oh, I'm no good compared to these other people, your race is over right then. You're finished. So you just have to clear those thoughts out of your head by an act of will, an act of will to banish them.
And I guess with the athletic metaphor as well, and thinking about how we cultivate that for the long term, what are the ways that you, I guess, de-stress and, you know, clear your mind? Do you have a meditation practice, or do you go out, play golf? I know you're a golfer.
I never de-stress, Joanna. I'm stressed 100% of the time. But seriously, I really, you know, they say Stephen King writes 365 days a year, and Woody Allen writes 365 days a year. And I'm not that good, but I'm not really a believer in vacations and stuff like that. You know, I take them, but I almost always am very happy to get back to work. So maybe I'm just crazy, but that's the way it works for me.
No, I know what you mean. All my trips are research trips. I'm taking my husband to Barcelona in a couple of weeks, and it's all research for books. So.
Well, that's good. That's a great way to travel.
It is.
Counts. That's good.
Now, I had another question for you. So you've had all kinds of things that people would consider to be successful. But what do you define as success in your career?
That's another great question. And I just wrote a blog about this. I don't even know if it's come out yet. But again, I think you can't look to the response of the marketplace as validation for your work, because they're going to love stuff that stinks and they're going to hate stuff that's great, right? So eventually, I think we all have to get to the place where we can be a judge of our own work. And I find that for me, that I can be a judge of my own work. When I look back on something, a book, whatever, I can be pretty objective and I can say, you know, that didn't work. This part wasn't right. That, you know, I could do a lot better. But also when something good comes out, you know, I can say, you know, that really worked and I'm proud of that. I'm glad I did it. So it's an ongoing self-teaching process for me, kind of keeping, teaching myself to be my own judge of my own stuff. And I think self-validation is another quality of a professional. I mean, that's a big word, but it's hard to understand maybe at first glance. But what it means is you judge your own stuff and you say to yourself, you know, good work, Joanna. You did good today. I don't care what anybody else says. I don't care if nobody gets it. You know, you did good. And I do feel like the muse is there and she's feeding us stuff. And I consider myself a servant of the muse. And I'm just trying to be true to her and bring her stuff down to earth as best I can as it comes through me.
Mm. No, I really like that. I think that's great. And in that way, we, you know, being true to the things that we want to write about. I guess the question is about self-censorship. I feel like only recently I've stopped self-censoring my writing because of the judgment, the fear of judgment, basically, which I guess is resistance. Do you still suffer from any fear of judgment in what you write?
No, I don't. I mean, I used to terribly. But again, I think that self-censorship is resistance. And it's also, I have a friend who just finished writing his first novel. And he told me that he kind of spewed a lot. He had files everywhere, right? And he found that in the end, he used everything. It was, some of it went into novel number two. But so I think in a way, self-censorship is an insult to the muse, to the goddess, because she's giving you something, right? There it is on the page. And who are you to say this is lousy? Because a lot of times, as I'm sure you know, Joanna, you look at something on Tuesday, you say, this is terrible. Then you look at it Thursday, and miraculously, it's become great, you know, 2 days later. Mm-hmm. So that's resistance, is clouding our judgment and making us see that. So I think self-censorship is the worst. Gotta get rid of that. That's an amateur habit.
Yeah, no, I realize that.
I'm not saying that to you, Joanna, just to anybody.
No, I agree. And
one thing, I don't mean to be proselytizing or whatever, preaching or anything like this, but I think that a lot of writers, even writers who are published and successful, are not tough-minded enough. And they... by which I mean they're not professional enough in the way they manage their own emotions through the course of things. And I fall prey to this too. And I have to kind of slap myself across the face. And, you know, I think, you know, you got to be a bit of a warrior to be a writer. And in many ways, it's harder being an artist than it is being a warrior because you're all alone. You don't have a structure. You don't have a commanding officer tells you what to do. I mean, think of the world that we live in, Joanna. It's like nobody makes us get up in the morning. Nobody pays us. Nobody pats us on the back. Nobody cracks the whip over us. Nobody shames us into doing anything. And nobody supports us. I mean, at the end of it, maybe your husband supports you or something. But I don't care how well-meaning or well-intentioned someone is, it doesn't help, you know? I'm sure you would agree with that. Nobody says at the end of the day, you did great. You really faced that one hard part and you really, you know, hung in there and you got through it, you know. You made something out of nothing today, you know. Or you only had an hour, but you took that hour and you sat down and you did, right? And so we have to do that for ourselves, you know. And I think it's much, much harder being a writer or an artist than anybody thinks. People think it's this idyllic life. We'll live in the country. We'll have a cottage in Dorset. You know, we'll sip tea and it'll be great, right? The sheep will be outside. It's beautiful. Instead, it's hell. You know, you're all alone facing your inner demons, you know? And so my hat's off to anybody that does it. Anybody that finishes a book and publishes a book or anything like that, you know, God bless them. I salute you.
That's a good pep talk. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. And I know we've got to go soon, but just a question about your small press. So you've got Black Irish Books, and there's you have a great motto, which is "Get in the ring," which you say is aiming to inspire those who don't want to wait for permission but want to take their destiny in their own fist, which I love. Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was that.
By the way, that's all from my partner Sean Coyne, who's the Black Irish in the family.
In the partnership. But yeah. You've seen the publishing industry change so much over the years. What are your thoughts right now towards like indie authors, towards the changes and what you guys are doing, I guess?
Well, that's a really tough question. And like with the Lionsgate, the book that we were talking about here, that had to be brought out by a mainstream publisher. It was too big a book. And it needed the push that a publisher could put behind it, getting it in bookstores and having a sales force and all that. But I found for like smaller books like The War of Art or Turning Pro, that they can be independently published. But as you know, you have to, if you're going to do that, you sort of have to have a presence on the web. You know, you have to blog or do something or speak. You have to get a following of people one way or another and kind of network around, which is not like what authors used to do. But when it works, indie publishing, it works great because you get all the money. And, you know, I think from the War of Art, it's been like a tenfold increase. Actually, the big controversy right now between Amazon and Hachette, you know, Hachette was the original publisher of the War of Art. And I would get 35 cents a copy of, you know, that's all on a book that was selling for $12.95 in American dollars. And now, now I get, you know, $3.50 a copy. So 10 times as much publishing it under Black Irish. So there's a lot to be said for that. You know, you only have to sell 1/10 as many books to make the same amount of money. So it, I don't know if it's really the future, Joanna, because it's, can everybody do that? Or is the world just going to be flooded with unknown people where there are no gatekeepers anymore? But I think for certain writers of certain books, it's a godsend. You know, God bless Amazon and Google that and PayPal that make all this possible.
Yeah, and I really like, just to let you know, I really like your audio versions, which you do yourself and release through Black Irish, don't you? Which is great. Do you enjoy that process of the audio?
Yeah, and that's it's another thing that's so easy. It's like to record audio costs like $500, right? That's all. And then you have an editor puts it together. That's all under $500. And you post it on the web and people buy it. It's unbelievable.
It's a great business model.
It's a great business model.
Yeah, and I like it's lovely for me to hear you because I do also listen to your audiobooks. So it's nice to hear the voice of the author, I think. And that's why I think audio is such a big thing. But anyway, we've got to finish. So where can people find you and your books online?
Just about everywhere on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, amazon.co.uk. We actually, Black Irish publishes it in England. So it's up there. And I have a website, as you know, that's just my name, stephenpressfield.com. And I'm there.
You're everywhere, and it's
I'm everywhere. Yeah. Just like everybody else is everywhere. You're everywhere.
Yeah, that is true.
The native fan, it's everywhere.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Steve. That was brilliant.
And thank you, Joanna. Thank you for being so prepared and for asking such great questions. It's a pleasure to meet you face to face over Skype.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.